Coming to you from New York City, it's the Friars Club Podcast. Established in 1904, the Friars Club is the birthplace of the celebrity roast and has counted the likes of Frank Sinatra, Jimmy Fallon, Billy Crystal, Barbara Streisand, and Johnny Carson among its members. So come on in for a drink and some laughs with your host, Joe Sibilia.
Hello and welcome to the Friars Club Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Sibilia, and today I am talking with an iconic comedian who is a favorite of mine for many years. He's known for his very innovative use of props and is currently headlining at the Luxor Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas, and his name is Carrot Top. Carrot Top, what an honor to be talking to you today. It's really a pleasure. As a fellow redhead, I feel a certain connection with you, so thank you for being on the Friars Club Podcast.
Well, great. And we're our people. We had to stick together, right?
As redheads. exactly.
A dying breed.
We can't tan, but we can make a show business.
Yes.
So, Carrot Top, I should start by asking you how exactly your involvement with the Friars Club began. I saw you had participated in the Jerry Springer roast back in 1999 in California. Was this your first involvement with the club?
It was indeed, yes. I think Howie Mandel invited me. A few others, and it was great. I never actually seen that kind of in person. You know, I'm watching as a kid, watching the roast of Dean Martin roasts and all that. We actually going to the Friars Club and sitting in the theater and seeing all the people in the dais and the kind of questions that were asked and it was great. It was a beautiful day, and it's such a great still art form. You know, the Friars roasting of someone is just always great. And I think that tradition should stay alive forever. It's great.
Now, were you a performer or were you only in the audience or on the dais at this?
Yes, I was a performer at the time, but I didn't perform at the event. I just was an onlooker that day.
Right. Did you make it to the Friars Club, the actual building in California or in New York for that matter?
Yes. I went in both. I've been inside both buildings.
So tell me about your experiences when you would go into the Friars Club in California or in New York. Who would you meet with and what brought you to the Friars Club in those situations?
I want to say Jeff Ross maybe got me in the door. And the people that he introduced me to were all it was everybody. It was the main guys. I mean, it's just, I can't think of names right now. But
Freddie Roman and people like that.
Yeah. I mean, he was the first one to shake my hand. And it was so long ago too, and you feel like, you know, you don't belong. But I think I feel better now. I've been doing this almost 40 years. I feel more like that. I could probably go in there and feel a little bit more about, hey guys, and be able to cut a joke. But you know, I was so green when they invited me there. I was just brand new in comedy, and it was bigger than life. It's the Friars Club, you know, and you're shaking hands with the best, you know, the biggest guys in the that run the thing. But they treated me like gold, man. They brought me in, showed me the whole thing. It definitely felt like royalty to go in there. You just felt like into a country club, you know, and there you're gonna see Chevy Chase getting, you know, dressed to play golf or something. it just had that feel to it and mystique to it and the history behind it, the history of the building and the number of people that have come in that room, brilliant people that have come up and probably told some of the best stories and jokes in the world.
So what do you remember about some of the people who got to perform, and who were some of the people that were sitting on the dais that day? I believe Bill Maher was there. Rodney, I think, was there.
Yeah, there was a whole bunch of people that almost shocked me that were there. You know, people that from Western movies. I forget the guy's name now, but he was standing next to me. I thought, this guy's like, he's like in this show called, I can't forget his name now, but damn it. But, yeah, it made no sense. It wasn't just comics. It was an eclectic gathering of comedians and actors and everybody. I think Regis Philbin was there. I mean, it was everybody.
And I know you were on Regis's television show quite a bit. What do you remember about working with Regis?
He was a nice guy, but a sloppy kisser. Other than that, I can't say anything better about him. He was always so genuinely nice to me. I mean, he was one of those guys, you go on the show and he genuinely had that sparkle in his eye, and he could not for the life of him think of how I came up with these little props. I'd get there in the morning and he said, what do you have for me today? And I'd do it, and at the end of the thing, we'd go to break, it'd be two spots, and he would sit there and hold up one of the props and stay in the crowd. How do you come up with this? I mean, look at this thing. Like, how did you think of this? And I don't know where I just thought of it. And he just really honestly was a fan from day one. And every time I'd see him out in public, he would try to explain to people, you should see what this kid builds. He builds his thing. And so, he was a good guy, great guy. I think I was on that show probably 40 times.
You were talking about how Regis would quiz you about how you would come up with your props. You have a very distinct style, and how did you come up with your approach to how you were going to do prop comedy? I think a lot of people think of the way Gallagher would approach it back in his day. Yeah. How did you approach how you were going to put your spin on prop comedy, where it was more of an invention that you come up with as opposed to just, you know, a pun in the way that Rip Taylor would do it?
That is exactly, you couldn't have said it better. That's exactly how I thought of the process from day one. I said, I can't be Gallagher. I can't be Rip Taylor. I've got to be my own thing. It was the most important thing in the world that I was unusual in my own delivery. And everything had to be kind of to the inventive kind of form. So it was each one would be an invention, literally. Like you could hold it and say, it wasn't something with a play on words as you used to, you know, with Rip Taylor. It wasn't like, hey, a butterfly and it's butter and a fly, or a shoehorn and a shoe and a horn. It had to be something that was just inventive. So it would be like a, you know, the paper cups and string telephone. I would have a third cup that came out for call waiting. you know, something that it could still be silly, but it would be kind of like, like a little smart, you know. So at the same time, one of my favorite comics, George Carlin, would always say, I could talk about abortion and I could talk about farting in the same breath. And it's kind of like this comedy. You can be really serious and really clever, and then the next one could be kind of stupid. I always just wanted to make sure that my show was built. Every prop had to be built that way, where it's like kind of inventive form. You know,
I was watching a show that profiled you, and you took them into the prop vault that you have. And I got to ask you, how much does it cost you to build all this stuff? I mean, you build props constantly. You're always adding new material.
Yeah.
What kind of a budget is there for your show that enables you to keep replenishing your supply?
That's funny. I have spent a lot of money on stuff over the years, and a lot of money on stuff that's never worked. It's failed. So it's just sitting in the warehouse collecting dust. But when I was a young comic, it was funnier because the guys that I'd travel around with, opening acts and whatnot, they would say to me all the time, like, oh my God, you spend almost all the money you make each night on your show. Because I had all this other stuff that I had to put in the show each night. It was like, I don't know. I'd have to have a couple eggs. I'd have to have powdered donuts. I had to have a box of you know, whatever. I had the strobe lights. And my friend's like, you have to go. It's the preparation alone for the show was insane, but it was totally worth it. I mean, you know, the joke with the donut was you get pulled over from a cop and you put the donut up and rub it all over your nose. So you look like you just did a whole bunch of cocaine, but you know, had to have that, you know, had to have that prop in my arsenal. So, if it was part of the equation of being a prop guy, you know, you're always spending a lot of money on all your stuff. That's for sure.
So in Las Vegas, there is no actual branch of the Friars Club as an F-R-I-A-R-S club, but there is a Friars Club, F-R-Y-E-R-S, that's sort of a spoof and an homage of the Friars in Los Angeles formerly and currently in New York. How did you become involved with the Las Vegas, quote-unquote, Friars Club? And are they still holding meetings these days?
I don't think I've ever been invited to one of those since it's been around.
Really?
But, I think maybe in the beginning they have like a lunch or something I think we might have gone to. And we had like the mayor, and we had Amazing Jonathan, and we had all these eclectic comics sit around and have lunch. I'm not quite sure if that's still going on. If it is, I got to find out if I'm still a member or not.
You got to hit them up. You got to get the most out of your membership.
Yeah, glad you brought that up. I got to check into that.
Please do. You've worked with so many Friars over the years, and two were in one movie with you. You did a movie called Dennis the Menace Strikes Again with Don Rickles and Betty White. What do you remember about working with Don Rickles, and what do you remember about Betty White for that matter?
A moment that I never forget. I mean, I literally just... I would say, pinch me, I'm dreaming. Every day when I'd get to drive to the set and be on a movie with these two people. I was in the movie where I played all these different characters. So I was in makeup 99% of the day. I'd be in a makeup trailer getting prosthetics and putting different wigs and things. And I played a 90-year-old man. So it took about 6 hours to get into this character. So I would see him on the set, you know, briefly, but when he'd come into the trailer every morning, Don Rickles every morning would walk in the trailer and just look at me, not say a word. And he'd say, "You're still in this thing, kid?" Said, "Yeah, I'm still in the movie. So as of now, you're still in this thing." And then he would cut, you know, jokes and but he would always be something really serious at first. And then he would grab my cheeks and make a joke and, you know, talk about the old days and ask me, you know, my if I wanted any advice from him, you know, in a funny way, like what kind of advice you know, what kind of advice you want, kid? What do you want? And Betty White was the sweetest woman. I was on the Tonight Show about 10 years after we filmed the movie, and I was backstage, and she was getting makeup on, and I walked in and I said, "Hey, Betty, it's Carrot Top," and she looked up at me and she's getting her makeup on, and I said, "You probably don't remember. I was curious if you remember being in a movie with me." And she's like, "I was in a movie with you?" And I said, I had a hunch you wouldn't remember." She goes, "We were in a movie?" And I said, "Yeah." She goes, "Who was in the movie?" And I said, "It was you, me, Don Rickles." And she goes, "Don Rickles is in it?" And I said, "Yeah." She goes, "Oh, it must have been horrible then." she still had her wit, you know?
Oh, my goodness. That's great. You know, I know that a lot of the comedians of the older generation of that era of the heyday of the Friars Club, but people like Carl Reiner, who was a Friar, Mel Brooks, George Carlin, as you had mentioned, these guys were all big fans of your work, as I am. So how would you find out that people like Mel Brooks were really into what you were doing with the prop comedy?
I was blown away, and I would never have guessed in a million years that they were fans of mine. Carl Reiner walked over to me after I had performed at this roast for HBO, for Larry Sanders.
That's right. You had a cameo in an episode of Larry Sanders' show.
Everyone in the world was on that, as I was on the dais, everybody. I mean, Al Franken and you name it. And he was there, and Mel Brooks. And when I got done performing my bit, Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner walked over to me, and they just said, "Where did you come from, and how did you come up with this idea? This stick is so great. You're brilliant. I love it. It's so fresh." And I remember looking over at Bill Maher or one of the ones that really didn't quite enjoy me so much, and just kind of gave him a look like, "Can you believe this? I'm getting praised by these two guys." And they kind of gave me a wink like, you know, "Hey, I think you're in the club. You know, you're a member. Those guys like you. Carl Reiner likes you. Then, you know, Mel Brooks likes you. You got to be in the club." So it was a great moment.
So when you were doing the Larry Sanders Show and you came out and played yourself, and you were the final comedian to go on in this episode to roast Larry Sanders, who was played by the late, great Gary Shandling, of course. Did you do your entire routine? What did you prepare to go out and do? Because they show a little bit of it and they kind of fade to the end of your monologue, and then Gary Shandling gets up and speaks in the episode.
I just did like 4 or 5 minutes. Like they would do in a roast. That's what I think. That's what was funny about it. I just came out at the end as a gag.
You're a special man, Larry Sanders.
Thank you.
But before you speak, we have one last surprise. Ladies and gentlemen, Carrot Top.
How are you? Now have a seat. How are you? No, stay seated, please. Stay seated. Here we go. Okay. I brought stuff. I thought my hair was big. You have a huge head. All right, here we go. I made this to wear when I go out looking for girls. This way I'm the best looking one in the group. Hey, all right. See, it's Larry. It's Larry, and that sucked. I can wear that one. Okay. Now time to pay tribute to a man who needs no introduction. And definitely not his own TV show, but as you can see, that's too fucking late. Please welcome the man of the hour, or as most women know him as, the Minute Man. Please welcome Larry Sanders.
But the funny thing about it was, I think it was supposed to not do well. It was supposed to be like funny, and everybody was laughing. So I actually turned it into something positive. So people really were like dying. It was really funny. So I remember the stuff that I was doing at the time. It was all current events. It was all things that were just happening, and everybody loved it. And that's when they all came over and said, "That was great, kid. Wow, you're really, where'd you come from? Out of nowhere."
So I know that you grew up, I believe, in Cocoa Beach, Florida, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. And you lived about two doors from Gallagher's manager, a gentleman by the name of Gary Proper, which, might I add, is quite an ironic name for a guy who manages a prop comic. And you first saw Gallagher perform at a local skate park, of all places. Was that when the prop comedy bug first bit you?
And exactly when it did. Yes, I went to see him perform and I was blown away. And I had never seen anything like it. And I went up to meet him and I met him and I said, you know, I want to be a comedian, you know, just like you. And he said, well, you should, you know, why not? I said, if I could do it, you could do it. And I said, I'm going to do it. So I went back to my house and it's just in front of my mirror and my dad's house. And I would pretend I was telling jokes. So, you know, I had a microphone and pretend microphone made out of cardboard. And I would stand in front of the mirror and just kind of do shtick and do kind of repeat some of his jokes, you know, Gallagher's jokes. I just heard them and I knew them. I do George Carlin jokes. And then one day I was in college and they had this open mic night and they said they were looking for people to come up and perform that evening. And I said, how about comedy? And they said, we don't have any comics. That'd be great. Are you a comic? And I said, no, but I'll give it a shot. And so I went up there and just did that exact thing, just told those jokes. And it went great. And I got done and came off. And every semester they'd have this little event. And each semester I was the comic and I'd go up. And each time I went up, each year, I would come up with a little bit more of my own kind of shtick to go along with the still maybe have the George Carlin joke, but now have a joke about the parking at school or the books or the classes or the teachers or the walking or the whatever it happened to be. And throw in a Reagan impression or something. And it just started to work. So there's a club down the street, West Palm Beach. And I went down, this is the real club. And I went down and auditioned for this woman. She said, oh my God, you are so funny, but I don't know where you got your jokes from. Is that a George Carlin joke? And I said, yeah. She goes, oh, you can't do George Carlin jokes. You got to do your own jokes. And I said, oh, well, I've been doing these and they've been doing great. She says, yeah, because you're at the college. No one knows. This is a real comedy club. So if you could come up with your own jokes, you know, I would love to see you again. So that's when the props came in. I started thinking visually of things that I could make. I stole this neighborhood crime watch sign that was in the college town that I lived in. And that was my first joke on stage. I held it up. I said, sorry, I'm late. I was in the neighborhood. I said, how good is their crime watch if they're not watching their signs? And that was my first big bang. And the lady loved it so much. She goes, that's so funny and it's clever and it's visual. Can you come up with more of those kind of things? And I said, sure, I'll go steal some more signs. So I just went around town looking for funny signs that I could put in the show. And one of them was called Butts Road, B-U-T-T-S Road. So I took that one. I said, I just came down Butts Road where all the assholes live. And I just started to develop this little routine that had signs and visuals. And I had, you know, three or four signs. And then I had an old lady's head with a wig on top of a hat. So when old people would drive, you'd see the head above the seat. And so then people were like really coming to, so the lady said, well, if you can get a few more of those, I'm going to put you in the contest because you have, this is all your stuff. And so I kept building, you know, here's a cowboy boot with a kickstand for rednecks so they don't fall down when they're drunk. And here's a high heel with a training wheel so women can walk in high heels. And then I had about 10 or 12 props and I went in this contest and won. And so then I just slowly from then just kept being booked. And I just kept, kept writing more jokes. The more jokes I could do, the more time I could do. So I just kept building and building and building. And finally, I saw the woman. I got about a half hour of stuff if I could maybe feature. And she said, okay, I'll let you feature. And so she let me do the 30-minute spot. And then that led on to being, you know, trying to be a headliner. And then, you know, as the story goes there, just kept going and going and going and building and developing, you know, an act, which now is considered probably, I mean, now an act now is it's like, it's crazy. I mean, it's everything from music to strobe lights, to videos, to fog machines. I mean, there's so much production in the show, which makes it like a rock and roll show. It's really, really fun.
It's interesting because somebody who, when I think of prop comedy, I don't think too many people think of him as a prop comic, but Paul Rubens, who was better known to people as Pee Wee Herman, when he started out, he was basically doing props as Pee-wee. What did you think of Paul Rubens and the whole Pee-wee Herman thing? And if you see the show that they taped at the Roxy, he opens a show with his bag of stuff. What did you think of that back in the day when you saw it?
Oh, it was very ahead of its very ahead of his time. I mean, Pee-wee, he was definitely was the morning kid thing, but there was always a dark element to Pee-wee Herman's show. You could tell the adult side. it was really, you know, it was geared for kids mostly, but the adults got it too. So he was brilliant in that way, but he would take a kid's show, but also make it kind of dark and sinister in a way where it would work for adults. Yeah, he was brilliant.
I was watching some of your appearances on Jerry Lewis's Muscular Dystrophy Association Labor Day Telethon. And Jerry Lewis, of course, was the abbot of the Friars Club here in New York for many years. And I always got a kick of how much Jerry loved you. You could tell he really enjoyed your stuff. How would you prepare to do a telethon for muscular dystrophy? Would you have to temper your act at all when you go up there? And what do you remember about Jerry Lewis?
Yes, he absolutely had to prepare differently for the telethon. That was a whole different thing. It was a really G-rated material bay show. So you had to pull out all your G family as much as you can, silly stuff. And the audience was a little tougher because, it was a serious, crowd. You know, we're talking about serious things. And one time I literally was there and I was about to go on. And Jerry said, "You're on next, kid." And I said, "Okay." And I'm standing in the wings and he walks out and he does this at least 5-minute monologue about this kid that just had died. I mean, like just had died.
Oh, geez.
And there was a video wall of the kid and how many years he was with Jerry and how many times he's been at the telethon, and he's just gone. And, everyone's crying. I mean, everyone, the band is crying. I mean, everyone. I look over at Ed and Ed says, I'm not going to go up after this, am I? And Ed says, "You might, kid, just be ready." And he said, Jerry said, "If there's one guy that could follow this and make everybody feel better, this is my favorite guy, Carrot Top, come on out." And I just went out and thanks, Jerry. And I just did my set. But the crowd was so, they felt so bad too for me. So the first minute or so was really rough. And then the crowd kind of probably dawned on them too, that this was a tough spot to be in, And it went great after that. It was hard. And then they were all laughing and I came off and Jerry gave me a big hug and he says, "I knew you could do it. I knew you could do it." And I wanted to punch him. I wanted to say, "I wasn't ready for that. You could have warned me."
Yeah.
But he said, "No, if anyone could do it, and I had total faith in you and you killed it. You killed it, kid." And so we became really good friends, Jerry. He was always in Vegas. I'd see him all the time. I'd go see him in the hospital when he was ill. He came to my show. His family's still great friends of mine. So yeah, Jerry was unique. What a guy. Yeah. I was very lucky to get to know and work with him.
Las Vegas was really a stomping ground for all of those people of the Friars Club era, Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin and Johnny Carson and so many of these other people. How do you think Las Vegas now compares to the old Las Vegas? Did you ever get to go see the old Las Vegas when you were growing up as a kid? Did you ever make it out there?
I did make it out there when I was a young kid. I mean, I don't remember hanging out, but I mean, I saw Charo and I saw Rich Little.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. I'll never forget that. Oh, my God. It was like, this is like the real deal. It's Vegas and these are the people I saw on Mike Douglas show and, aging myself.
Oh, you saw a taping of the Mike Douglas show in Vegas.
Awesome. So, yeah, Vegas. And in fact, there's a bit that I do in my show, and I've just now brand new. I mean, I've done it like 1 week. I do a joke about the headliner. I said, I have a residency in Vegas. I've had it 17 years. I said, and it's fun. And I said, but I'm like the new guy. So whatever happened to the old guy? I don't even bring up like the Rat Pack. I say their name. Like, remember the Rat Pack? And you remember Tom Jones? That guy was rock and roll. That guy. And so the women would throw panties at him, right? So I do the whole "What's New, Pussycat" song. And I dance across the stage with the "What's New, Pussycat." And then I have this little machine. It's like almost like a leaf blower that throws up panties at me and hits me right in the right in the face. And then I sniff them and I throw them back and I go, "Thank you, darling." And I'm pretending to be Tom Jones. And then I said, "That's sad that I actually had to have a machine do it." They would actually throw panties. I had to have a machine do it. But it's brand new. It's been a week old and it kills. I don't know if the older people because I get a lot of younger people, they have no idea who Tom Jones is. So it's still funny and silly just by the fact that there's panties being thrown at me. But the older folks that remember him really love it. I mean, because it was true. That's my homage to the old school Vegas. Yeah.
And Tom Jones, of course, was a Friar and has been honored by the Friars Club. He's another icon. I know that you have had your own television show on the Cartoon Network. Yeah. It was called Carrot Top's AM Mayhem. You hosted this from 1994 to 1996, and Soupy Sales, who was a member of the Friars, was a pioneer of children's television. What was your approach to doing the show, and what was your favorite part about working on that show all those years ago?
Well, yeah, it was real crazy because they came to me and they just basically said, you know, there's no Pee Wee Herman show anymore, and there's no, we need a show on. Now, I didn't really know what the show was going to be or what's about. They wanted to do, you know, it was more of me doing like bumpers into the other shows.
Right.
So I was coming on again in character. It's like my brother, you know, or my grandmother. And I would say, you know, it's Grandma Top, and I just wanted to say, coming up next, Daffy Duck and Friends, and we do, you know. So there was a lot of bumpers and a lot of little skits, me doing. I think they wanted the show to grow a little bit more into a character-driven show where I was actually in the show more than I was. It was more of me just doing, you know, in and outs of the other cartoons. But it was fun. It was a day where, looking back, I had never done a TV show and I had no idea what I was doing. Probably shouldn't have been on there, but it was an experience, that's for sure. I remember running into Ted Turner. That's how much, you know, the show, how many people saw the show. I was with Ted Turner one day and I said, hey Ted, thanks for letting me be part of your network. And he says, you have a show on my network? And I said, yeah, Cartoon. Seriously, I said, yeah, I have a show on Cartoon Network. He goes, you do? And I go, yeah. He's like, oh, that's cool. Isn't you never seen it? He goes, no. Do you know you have a network, right? At least you do know you have a network. So
Ted Turner and Betty White, they both
yeah, no clue. Track. Yeah, there's a running theme here that everyone tries to forget working with me.
I certainly won't. This is a real treat for me. Another icon that you worked with of comedy was Jonathan Winters. You did a Showtime special with him back in 1993. What was Jonathan Winters like in your experience to work with?
Jonathan Winters was his own I don't even know if that was Jonathan Winters that I had dinner with. It might have been Bill Smith. This guy was genius. He says to me, all right, I'm going to take all you guys to dinner. So there's like six comics and him. So they take us. Oh, and I know exactly. There's still another restaurant we went to. Went there. We went upstairs. We all sat at the table. He told everybody where they wanted to sit. He sat next to me and he said, now, we're going to storm these beaches in the next few minutes. You guys got to be prepared. So we're thinking he's using like terms like, oh, like for the comedy special, you know, we're about to storm these beaches and you guys ready for the show. And then he turns around and he goes talking to the wall and he starts just yelling, you know, like, Captain, we got to get these soldiers down and pronto. And where's the ship? And then he looked back and he started talking to us about something and he'd go back to the wall. And I think he might've been, they said prior to the meeting, they said, listen, he's a little out there. Just don't be, you know, warned by it. Just, he's a little out there. And so he was out there. So we just were, you know, we had dinner and we answered all our duties that we had to do. But I think he was in another world. But we did the special. It was great. He went up and did his part that he did. He did his stand up and then we did our stand up. And then he would go up and do just ad lib for hours upon hours. And the camera guy's like, we got to go. We got to get this stuff. So that was a pretty cool moment sitting there having dinner with Jonathan Winters. Again, one of my heroes when I was a kid. He was one of my all time heroes. I'd see him the Tonight Show. He'd come out with that hat on. And I would just lose my mind. I'm like, this guy's funny. He was funny before he spoke. He just was a funny guy.
He was a genius, as was Robin Williams. I know you worked with Robin, and Robin was involved with the Friars.
Probably nobody funnier than Robin Williams.
But you mentioned Out of This World, and you were a guest on one of my favorite talk shows of all time, Space Ghost Coast to Coast.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So how do you get interviewed by a cartoon character?
Yeah, you sit in a room and some guy just talks to you. It's a machine. He just talks to you. Yeah. It was so funny because that was such a big show back then. I remember the people saying, you got to get on Space Ghost Coast to Coast because it's like it's legitimatizing. Right. And I'm like, OK. And I was on the Cartoon Network, naturally. So I think I probably weaseled my way on that way because I was on the network. But yeah, it was weird. When I did it, I got so much feedback from it. It was like one of those shows you do and you get instant feedback. There hasn't been that many shows, even since I've done this for a living, like 38 years, where you get instant, just all of a sudden people just walk, like, you know, Family Guy. They'll walk up to me and say, dude, Family Guy, fuck, you were great in that. I go, oh, great.
Let the record show you never did the seesaw bit that they do in the episode.
No, yeah, I did do it. I mean, I did do the bit, but I did the voice.
You did the voice. So you never done that on stage.
Yeah. No, I fought that thing and fought that thing because I thought it was horrible. And they all could not believe I thought it was horrible. They thought it was the best thing ever they've ever written. They thought it was such a funny prop. And I said, I please don't want to do it. I hate it. And because it fell in that round of, you know, seesaw. It was a total pun. It was total nonsense. But for that thing and that show and for that scene, it worked. That's why he did it. It did work. People come up to me and like, seriously, all the time and say, dude, seesaw. So I'm like, okay, it must have worked. I have the thing though. I've got the cell.
Oh, that's great.
They did give me the cell. Yeah, I got that backstage in Vegas. People love it. In fact, one of the first things people see when they walk into my dressing room is that. They go, oh, dude, you got that? And I'm like, yeah. And they weren't going to give it to me either. I said, you know, I was in that, but they weren't going to give it to me. So I had to beg and beg and beg to get that cell. People always to this day freak out. Family Guy, you know, the Hangover. Like, what was that like? What was it like being in the Hangover? I said, well, you know, the Hangover was what it was. And, you know, it wasn't even a movie yet. It just was these guys that no one knew came into my dressing room and they were partying with me. And I said, hey, what would Carrot Top do? Like, what would be funny that Carrot Top would do if these guys were partying? I said, well, doing blow would be pretty funny because Carrot Top doesn't do drugs. So I thought we could be doing cocaine. That'd be funny. And the guy's like, seriously, you'll do that? And I'm like, well, yeah. And we're not, as long as it's not real cocaine. So the guys were like, all, you know, Zach had his shirt off. I was doing lines off his belly. And it was crazy. And it was exactly what they wanted out of the movie. And they wanted me to be in the movie. It was this crazy guy, you know, like I'm really not this crazy guy. So they wanted me to be portrayed as, you know, they go to Vegas and they run into Carrot Top and oh my God, they're doing blow. How great is that? So it was fun.
Is there anything really now that compares to television 30 years ago where you could go on the Tonight Show and have one hit and everybody would know who you are? I know you did Star Search. I don't know if that had that same impact or not.
I think maybe a Netflix special. And the reason I say that, let's say like Chris Rock's Netflix special he just did. I mean, the day after he did it, he got so much press and so much people were talking about it. So that might be an actual special on, you know, on Netflix or something like that, that where people see. I think he got prime time. You could have a special buried in some other network that no one's going to see. That seems to be a good outlet, though. Chris Rock was really, really popular and got tons and tons of hits and reviews. The last thing that I did that I got that kind of exposure, which I said to this day, and I don't make this up as a joke, I say probably a dozen people or more every day say, Joe Rogan, you were fucking great on Joe Rogan. So there's an outlet that is instant. You do that show and you walk down the street and people are like, great job on Joe.
Everybody knows it.
Oh, everyone knows it. I mean, I'm not kidding you. I leave here, I go get lunch. Someone at lunch will lean over and say, dude, you were great on Joe Rogan, man.
How long ago was this now that you did that?
9 months ago, maybe. And what's the strange part about it, you still got legs. And what I think the strange part about it was that everyone knows me from that one type of thing, like the props and the, you know, grabbing stuff out of the trunk and being silly and manic and kind of, you know, hey, buddy, next joke, you know, kind of thing. And this Joe Rogan was like, this is what you and I are doing. It was just me sitting at a table talking about comedy and how I got into comedy and how my parents didn't get it and, you know, what I did to get. So it was really, I think for the audience members, if they were a Carrot Top fan, they were very interested to listen to how it all started and came. And if they weren't a fan, I turned them in. Like some guy said, you were coming on, and I didn't know who you were. And I listened to it, and you fucking was great. You turned me around, and wow, now I had to look you up. So hopefully sometimes, you know, you get people that even at my show that might not know who I am or not really want to go to the show, you know, their friends will say, no, no, it's great. You really got to go. And then they go, okay, we'll go see Carrot Top. And then they come and they're pleasantly surprised and they have a pleasantly have a good time. Shockingly, I was like that with a kid. I can't believe it was that good. I did not think it was going to be good. So it's fun to get people turned around, like people that just after the show. I love when people say that, like, never would have seen I saw you. I've never really been a fan, but fuck, you're fun. That was a good show. So you've won them over in a sense.
But I could tell you, I was a fan before you did the Joe Rogan podcast, and I was only more of a fan.
No,
as you've proven today, you have a lot of great stories and have had so many great experiences in the business.
People ask me all the time, who's your new favorite comic? And I'm always like, God, you know what? I don't know. Because I'm old and I'm lazy. I don't force myself to find these new guys. Like when I lived in LA, I'd go to the comedy club and I'd sit in the back and I'd watch all these. I'd never heard of any of them. I'd be there all night. There'd be 20 comics. And I'm like, never heard of one. Then you get like a Chris Rock might pop in and do a set and everybody goes nuts. But it was really, truly just young comics. And you're like, wow, they're clever. And I haven't seen anyone do that kind of style. Like there's a lot of really, really clever guys out there that are reinventing stand-up in a lot of ways. And that's what I think is too. What I love seeing is if you can reinvent it in a certain way. I've seen some young comics that have this kind of interesting style of voice, how they hold themselves on stage where it's just so unique, it's hard not to watch them. There's this girl, I forget her name now. She came to this festival in Vegas and about 10 of them came back to see my show. And out of all these 10 girls, they're all comics. This one in particular, just she had it. I don't know what it was, but she just had it. She had a funny face. She just had this weird look on her face and her mouth and she talk. And it was like she could read the phone book and be funny. So I said, you're going to be a huge star. I told that girl. But the Friars Club is you know, the Mac Daddy of all, you know, and that's what I am. I'm kind of like I love the old school. I love watching old school stuff. That's my I try to get into the young people's, but I can watch old comedy every day.
You and me both. I'm a young guy, and I'm very much the same way. I'm just an old soul, and it struck me that you're very much an old soul right away from when we started talking today. Why do you think that the Friars Club, after all these years, continues to be a source of fascination to the public?
I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, I think the fact that it's been around so long, and I think the people that know the history behind it, we don't want to lose that history. It's an art form that I think is unique. Speaking of unique, and it's kind of built into our, especially as comics. I mean, if you're a stand-up comic, that's like the holy grail to everything. So that's gotta stay. You know, everyone talks about, you know, even old movies. You know, to this, probably every day, someone somewhere right now is talking about there's no way they can remake Blazing Saddles today. There's no way. So people are still talking about the movies that they did back in those days. We're still classic movies that'll not only always stay classic, but the Friars Club, you know, hosts all these people. This is where all the geniuses go, you know. So I hope it stays around forever, and I hope I get to. It's been a while. I'd like to go up. The one in New York was very cool because it was that old, you know, you feel like you're Arthur when you're going into his dad's business place, and he's like, Arthur's here to see you, sir. My dad. And it's just that building and that old school. And it's like, you know, it's New York. It's the real deal. You don't mess around with the Friars, you know, they can see the real deal.
Well, Carrot Top, all I can say is it has been an honor and a pleasure to talk to you. You are very insightful, very funny, and this has been a delight from one ginger to another. So thank you for making the time for me today for the Friars Club podcast. And I do hope that you and I will get together at the Friars one of these days soon here in New York.
Yeah.
Because it would be an absolute delight to have you back at the Friars Club.
That would be great, my man. Thank you for chatting.
Thanks for listening to the Friars Club podcast. Please be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. For more information on the Friars Club, please visit friarsclub.com. We hope to see you there.